This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Sunday Arts on Joy 94.9.
I've just broken the microphone.
Oh, no, David, it's all right. See what happens when you leave me by myself to do these things. Well, and you're here this afternoon with Neil, David, and Fiona.
Hello.
Hello, everyone.
Now, Fiona, we're just going to tell everyone, Brendan is away again this week. His grandmother died, unfortunately, and he's gone back to Queensland for the funeral this week. He went to see her before she died last week, which was lovely that he had a chance to, and he's now back for the funeral, so that's why Brendan's not on today. Fiona. Your big moment today, your first segment, we've been building it up for the last couple of weeks. Now, you're going to have a special once a month, about a half an hour interview with somebody, and we're calling it Fiona Presents. Is that what you want, or you're still playing around with the name?
I'm still playing around with the name, but I think that Fiona Brooke Presents is pretty good.
Yep.
Okay. You know, it builds on my profile.
Absolutely.
As much as everyone else's.
Yes.
You know, got to row my own boat a little bit.
Right.
But it is a bit of a work in progress.
Okay.
But the most exciting news is, of course, that our interview subject today is a gentleman by the name of Jack Ferver.
Right.
Who is a very well-known New York-based choreographer, director, actor, and performance artist.
Right. And you're interviewing him by yourself. You haven't got the rest of the team on board. It's your little interview.
I know, and I'm a little bit nervous, I have to admit. But
you'll
think
be brilliant.
Well, I think I'm very lucky because he's a very charismatic person and a good talker.
Well, make sure you don't let him do all the talking, that you have to get your bit in as well.
So I will.
So all the very best with that. And,
Thank you,
that's
David.
In about a half an hour's time or so, isn't it?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. Now, there's no film review today for obvious reasons, Neil.
Yeah, exactly right.
But I just want to make a mention of something major that's happened this week in my life. It's the 50th anniversary, can you believe, 50 years of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It was the album that, by this stage, the Beatles weren't touring anymore. They were only recording, and they were always breaking ground with, Revolver was the album before, where they were experimenting. You've got to remember there were only four-track recording, studios in the era, and they were doing incredible things with George Martin, who was their producer, and they were taping things backwards and then making that part of the music. So all the effects that they started to use were really groundbreaking. And then they released Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which shocked the world because it was so revolutionary and so uniquely different to anything that anyone else was doing, even to the extent that Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys, who was always in envy of the Beatles, just said, I am devastated. I can't believe they've taken this giant leap away from everyone else and has taken us all, by surprise, and we're left in their wake. That's how revolutionary this album was, Sgt. Pepper's. And even the album cover, if you haven't seen it, Google it, because it is the most amazing. It's all famous people who have died. That's everyone that's in the photo. It's just the most amazing. And it was also before digital digital photos. So they were actually all cutouts or whatever of all these famous people that they had their photo taken then in front of. So, you know, pretty amazing. Everything they were doing was unbelievably special. And so I thought it was only appropriate that we play a song from it today. And probably one of the most commercial songs on the album, because it's got songs like, well, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band, and then of course Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, yep. and tracks like that. But I thought we'd go for a more a subtler one instead of being psychedelic. So we're going to play A Little Help from My Friends. The first time that Ringo Starr sang on, no, sorry, second time that Ringo had sung on one of their songs. Yep. And then it became, they never released it as a single, Little Help from My Friends, but then Joe Cocker released it as a single, and it became a huge hit for Joe Cocker. And as a matter of fact, it made him a household name. So here's the Beatles version of A Little Help from My Friends, sung by Ringo Starr from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, celebrating its 50th year this week. You're on Joy.
Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Sunday Arts here on Joy 94.9. And this afternoon, our first guests are Jamie Moffat and Orthon Charalambos from Savoy Opera. Good afternoon, guys.
Good afternoon.
So we always like to get it, and especially opera singers, because you've had such colourful histories. Well, one would hope. So let's have a find out. Jamie, what's your background?
My background, I initially trained as a pianist. I was a pianist for years and years and years, and then I got run over and
what
smashed
do you mean?
Up my... this is very embarrassing. I was leaving a Seekers concert.
Which one? not the one at My Music Bowl.
No, well, I'm not that old. It was the one... It was at... the concert hall, and I was in an accident, and I smashed up my left hand.
Oh.
And so I thought, I'll give singing a try. Right. And then I went and sang for this teacher, and she said, no, you're a much better singer than you are a pianist. So you'll find out, and I haven't sort of really looked back
since. Right. So how devastating was that at the moment that you would have woken up in a hospital or something, did you? Or
I didn't, but look, I heard the Seekers. So, I mean, how bad can it be?
Exactly. Judith Durham's voice, how beautiful.
That was an extraordinary, or still is an extraordinary voice, yeah. Yes.
And as a singer, you know, like, what is hearing another voice like hers mean to you?
Oh, look, I've been obsessed with singers for years, most of my life. You know, my house is a shrine to Dame Nellie Melba.
Oh, right.
So I don't think there's anything as exciting or as individual as a human voice. And, you know, there are some voices out there that are just absolutely unmistakable. This gentleman to my left is one of them.
Far too kind.
Well, I'm known for it. And
you're funny.
So, yeah, it is an exaggeration to say singing is my life, but it's very close to it.
Okay. And what other productions have you been in? Could you travel a bit?
Yes. I was going to say I've done the rounds, but that might be misconstrued. look, I've sung with a lot of companies. I met this gentleman when we worked with City Opera last year for Ariadne of Naxos, and I've worked with Savoy many times in the past and recently got roped back in for the Tales of
Right.
Hoffman.
Well, mentioning Savoy a bit before we get to our other guest, your mate here, what is Savoy Opera?
Savoy Opera is celebrating its 75th anniversary next year, which is quite an achievement.
Yeah.
Very fine achievement.
Older than the Beatles.
Older than the Beatles. Sergeant Pepper. Fractionally older than me. they primarily do Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yep.
And they do good, solid productions of GNS, and sometimes they branch out. And they decided, for whatever reason, that The Tales of Hoffman was the way to go for this year, and I found myself tapped on the shoulder and
here you
roped
are.
Into one role after another.
The rest is history. Now, what about yourself? What's your background?
Well, it's not as colourful as Jamie's. I didn't get hit by any cars, thankfully. having said that, though, I did have a breakup, so I thought I needed something to change my outlook somewhat. So I went and saw a singing teacher, and I said, look, I'll sing something for you. Just be honest. Let me know whether I can sing or not.
How old?
Mid-20s.
Right. So you hadn't done anything about it before
nothing
then?
Nothing at all.
But in the shower you knew that you might have had something?
Yeah, a couple of friends had said stuff, and I thought, look, let's just get an honest opinion. So I did. And I sang something for her, and she said, look, it's a good voice. You're a lyric tenor. And I thought, tenor? That's like that Pavarotti bloke, isn't it? So I thought, you know, I might just keep going with this for a while. So, did it for a little bit, let it go, and then came back into it. And we've been close to 10 years now, and did an audition with Melbourne City Opera.
Yeah,
my first opera, which was at Anani, and I've been doing stuff ever since.
Okay. Yeah. And is it your total love now, your passion?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, look, I think we've both got full-time jobs. I work in the IT industry, but that's kind of just for, you know, making sure the mortgage and that stuff gets paid. But this is for you.
Yep.
And that's the way I look at it. So absolutely, yes.
Yeah. And you haven't travelled with, opera?
No.
Right. Why? Because the mortgage?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it doesn't pay it anywhere near as well.
The IT business.
So tell us, Tales of Hoffman, what's the premise of the story?
Jamie's probably in a better position, but Hoffman is a...
Why is he in a better position? But you're going to tell us.
Well, I'll tell you
and then
my perspective on Hoffman.
I like to talk more.
Well, Jamie's been involved with Opera Australia with this production as well some time ago with Sutherland and Bonnie, you didn't want to say that. I'll make that mention for you.
Just drop a few more names.
Drop a few names.
Really? On stage with her?
No, I wasn't on stage. It was actually after Sutherland's retirement, although this was the first opera I ever saw, and it was with Joan Sutherland, and she sang all the four soprano roles, and I was absolutely terrified of it. But some years ago, I was roped in as a... as an assistant to Richard Bonning to prepare the score for a revival of The Tales of Hoffman.
Right.
And it was the most amazing 3 months of... because there are so many different editions of this score, and so I found myself doing it again.
Yeah.
People kept running to me saying, which version do we use for Act 3?
Right.
It's an amazing...
Why are there so many versions?
Because Offenbach died before he finished it.
Right.
Basically. He had it all mapped out, then he dropped dead. And a whole lot of people decided that the time had come to try and reassemble it. And there's no definitive version of it. Some use dialogue, some use recitative. There's two different versions of the Giulietta story. It's got scholars arguing for centuries and probably will have forevermore.
That's the wonderful thing about opera, isn't it? Is that you never stop learning. There's so many incredible... Well, especially somebody like yourself who came into opera fairly late in
life.
Yes,
that's right.
It must be fascinating, the backstories.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I tend to learn the operas as I do them. Some people grow up with this stuff and they go to operas and they go with their parents and all that sort of stuff. So my parents were absolutely not interested in this stuff whatsoever. I tend to learn them as I go. So I've never done a Bohème, which I've always loved, mind you. But I got a chance to do Rodolfo and just recently done a Butterfly and did a Pinkerton in that as well. So you kind of just get to learn this stuff and you just build up a wonderful appreciation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as I was saying, the backstories of all the intrigue that goes on behind the scenes. Like Jamie, why does it keep on exciting you?
Look, I don't know. I think I've actually got a similar situation in that none of my family are even remotely musical, not interested in opera. My poor father is coming to the Tales of Hoffmann because he's never actually seen me in an opera. He's absolutely determined to.
Why hasn't he been before?
Because he is more a Melbourne Football Club type of person. Okay. And I keep saying, Dad, just stick to what you like. But he's determined. He wants to see me in something. And this is a really good one for him to see because it's very accessible.
Yeah.
Not to belittle him or anything, but unless you've actually jumped in the deep end with opera, it can be a little hard.
So tell us about Savoy Opera. The production, obviously, it costs so much money to put on an opera. How many people are in the cast?
Gosh, there's about 15 principals.
There is, yes.
And I think the chorus is around about 30 or 40. So there's a lot of people in it,
And a lot of people, that's a lot of people to costume.
Mm.
And then the sets, of course.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And the orchestra, what orchestra are you using?
We've recruited an orchestra for it. I think it's around about 22 pieces.
Yeah, 22 or 23 pieces.
Right, okay. That's so it's a big challenge, isn't it, putting something like this on?
It's always a huge challenge. The expenses of putting it on are extraordinary. The amount of fundraising that goes on and begging and borrowing and that goes on to make it happen. But it always does. And, of course, it very much relies on people coming out to see it.
Yeah. Mm. And that's why, get out there, people, and buy a ticket, for God's sake. And rehearsals, how are they going?
Fabulous.
It's rehearsal day today.
Yes, it is.
We were yanked out of one to come to this side, but it was good.
Right.
We got thrown into an Uber and talked to these people.
And here you are. So how many days a week are you rehearsing at this stage?
Look, I mean, Savoy are pretty good in that respect. We'd probably do a couple of days a week. There are other companies that maybe do three and four days. Mm. But, sort of Tuesday and Sunday, except for production weeks, performance weeks like the one coming up, we'll spend most of the time in the theatre.
Yep. And do you take holidays? You go to work and then do this at night and then get up in the morning.
Yeah, try to sneak out of work a bit early
for a nana nap before you go on
stage. Yeah, something
like
that. So we have a Thursday production the following week. So, we'll probably just say, I'm out of here. Thank you very much.
You create a diversion at work.
Yeah. And run.
Does everyone at work know?
Oh, yeah, most of my work colleagues know.
Right. Do they come?
Yeah, they do, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Which would be really nice because it would be a lot of their first time maybe going to opera.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens. They kind of say, well, you're an opera singer, great, and you might do something at the Christmas party, which I did last year. And then they go, we'd love to come and see you. And they come out and they go, we didn't realise you could do that.
And I actually enjoyed the experience.
And that too, absolutely.
Because it was before a very elitist form of art, wasn't it, opera, which those barriers have been broken down so much, but it's now trying to get people through the door to see it, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Opera companies try different things from time to time, and I remember we did a 2014 production of Bohème, and that was at Ripponlea.
Mm.
And I think it was the first time in Australia. Certainly, they had the Sir titles stream to people's iPhones and iPads in the audience.
Oh, really?
Which was fantastic.
But
so
is that bad in a way, because then people are looking down? They're not watching?
They had the option of, there were screens as well.
Oh, okay.
But if you're right at the back and if you have absolutely no idea what the artists are singing, then having that there, you can always sort of lift it up and look up and just and read. So it was certainly well received.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I find when I see a foreign film and, you know, like with the subtitles, I actually get a little bit annoyed because, especially foreign films, they usually look so beautiful that you don't want to be reading. So therefore sometimes you lose the plot. But I think the wonderful thing about opera is you don't have to follow it that closely,
do
you?
No.
And it is wonderful to see. So what era is the whole setting for it? Have you gone back to the original or
It's a 19th century setting where there are a lot of very gimmicky productions of Tales of Hoffman. We're not doing that. We're going back to a fairly literal, but, you know, imaginative production.
Yep.
And there are three different stories and they've got three different settings. So it's certainly looking fantastic. It's just looking amazing. How they've managed to put it all together like this, I've no idea.
But, yeah.
I'm so impressed.
Okay. So it's showing from the 6th, 7th, 11th and 13th of May.
That's correct.
Where's it on?
It is at the Phoenix Theatre in Elwood.
In Elwood, yeah, which is part of the school.
It is, yes.
And which is a great theatre, actually.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful.
A really good. Okay, so and ticket sales, or do you know, if I put you on the spot here, if you go to Savoy Opera online, you'll be able to find
it. There is a link on our website, which is savoyoperacompany.com.
I believe trybooking.com as well.
And Trybooking, yeah.
Brilliant. So don't miss it. Go out there and support these wonderful gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming in, and especially on a day where you should be working. Get back there. You're going back, are you?
We are going straight back.
Yes.
Going back.
Good on you. Thank you so much. It's Tales of Hoffman by Savoy Opera, and it starts on the 6th of May. You're on Joy 94.9.
Okay, you're listening to Joy 94.9 Sunday Magazine, and what you heard before was the Doll Song from the Tales of Hoffman Opera, and that was a performance by Aaron Morley at the Met. Now, David, that was our guest that we just had previously. Now we have an art in the studio, David Cook, who's going to be talking about his book, Bear It Up.
Hello, Cookie, David. Better known as Cookie.
Yes.
So a lot of people at Joy will know you. Why?
I have been, a couple of years ago, the presenter of The Cubby House, which later followed on with The Woods as
The Bear Show.
The sequel as The Bear Show, yeah.
Right, okay. So what is your fascination with the bears? And do you call yourself a bear?
Yes, I am a bear. I was called a cub very many, many years before I identified with what the bear scene and who the bears were. So I had been identified for a long time, and if anybody knows me physically, I am no swim model. I am no
But you're not that overweight, though.
No, and one of the things that I find has been very lacking in any media for a long time is positive endomorph.
Oh, yeah.
Endomorph-style models. Now, you're starting to get some with the likes of, you know, John Candy and some of the other talk show hosts that are now coming out and through in America. But generally speaking, there has never been a visual representation that a lot of larger guys can look to and say, I relate to that.
Well, there's that English actor, singer, who's got a late night show. And
James Corden.
Yeah. You know, like, and he's an amazing dancer.
Yes.
You know, he does Broadway shows and you know, like a lot of movies and stuff as well. And he's a little bit overweight and doesn't seem to bother him at all.
Well, that's right. But, you know, I find he's one of very rare few that are still in our sort of media scope at the moment. And there are people slowly coming through that field that people can start to relate to. But certainly when I was sort of coming out and sort of growing up in my 20s in the late decade of last year, that never was really the case that I found. So,
yep.
And to be honest, I've since now gone to America and I've been through Europe. And one of the things that I found when I was trying to look for books or just visual representation of this was either when you looked at a bear, they either were muscle guys, hairy guys, both of which weren't bulky, unless it was muscle bulky, or it was illustration.
Yep.
So very few books or even really covered the realistic view of what larger guys can look like.
Yep. And... where did the love of photography come from?
I must admit a few of my friends kind of encouraged me because I got my first camera from my parents as a hand-me-down, and over the years I've had a lot of friends who've kind of encouraged me to get better and better cameras, and eventually a friend who I later did the radio show for Cubby House with actually got me involved in looking at things in a more professional way.
Right.
So I took it from just the point-and-shoot amateur that I was at the time to now striving to be better and better at honing in on those skills.
Right. Why did you want to, I mean, you're here to talk about a book called Bear It Up.
Yes.
Why did you want to put a book together? Because these days it's not the norm to publish a book.
That is true. The intent of the book came from the lack of imagery that I felt that the bear community had been using in terms of realistically representing who we were as the actual audience. So creating a book, I felt, was certainly a physical medium because I was always a very tactile person.
Yep.
In terms of wanting to actually create something that I could feel with my hands, you could take your time with, and you could just sit down and, like reading a book, you could sit down and look at imagery and just take your time with it, and it's portable.
And what I love about, you know, having a look at the book that you've got sitting in front of you now, and I'm going to get you to hand it to me so I can have a better look, is that the style of the way you've done it is really, you know, it's of a real studio quality, isn't it?
Yes, yes, thank you. The initial concept started coming out of literally my garage, which is my current studio, really. But over time, I realised there were other spaces that I wanted to explore. And there was places like the Laird Hotel, which I've previously done photography at.
Yeah, and that features in here with some of the photos.
With some, they're actually some of their bartenders.
Oh, okay.
They are actually willing to model for it. But I also use other studio spaces such as Awesome Source, which is a lot of where a lot of the white background shots came from, because they actually set up a specific studio for more student accessibility fees.
Yep.
And even the back of Eagle Leather.
Yep.
They had a seminar room before it became the leather working room.
Yep.
And I actually was able to use that facility to get some of the more black backdrop specific shots.
Now, I bet you everyone was pretty excited about when you... how long ago did you announce that you were going to do this book?
Three years ago.
It's taken that long?
It has.
Yep.
Look, one of the biggest troubles is when you start targeting an audience that doesn't always aspire to have a good self body image, and encouraging people to say, hey, I think you're sexy, I would like to take photos of you, that doesn't come across as creepy and sexual and so totally not what people were actually getting, was the people who then were willing to come and have their photos taken. It just took a long time to slowly get that group of people together and hone enough photos to actually create a physical medium.
And what was the reaction from people? You know, like, did they, with some of the gay community, where, you know, would jump at an opportunity to have your photo taken and to be in a book, or was there a lot of people that were quite shy on it?
Very shy. Look, I was the photographer for Vic Bears for very many years, just doing event photography.
Yep.
And I was certainly getting a lot of the, oh, I don't want to be in photos, I'm not pretty enough sort of attitude.
Aww.
And which I, as someone who's equally attracted to bears as well as being one, was very sort of downtrodden in that they didn't feel but that they were.
It can be sexy.
Well, that's right.
It can be, and that's what you've done with some of these photos. You know, like they're, and or some with a sense of humour as well, which is good.
Exactly. So one of the things that really came out of doing a lot of these shots is when the models came through. Like, A, I had some models specifically come to me specifically because they were happy for me to take their photos, but also some people came through and at the end of it felt like they were a lot more comfortable in their skin. The fact that they could actually see themselves, not just in the mirror, but certainly through somebody else's eyes and say, I am sexy, and actually embrace that and empower themselves with that.
Yep. Because the bear community seems to have got stronger in the, say, the last 10 years, hasn't it? You know, like, it's, the festival that's on the, must be coming up soon, is it?
Or Southern,
is it
just, Southern Hibernation, yeah. Yes, Queen's Birthday Weekend, for those who don't know.
It's a huge event, isn't it?
It is, and it's certainly, like, the more it is carried through the years, the more it becomes a staple thing that most people look towards, specifically as, unfortunately, venues are slowly closing down their doors. This is one of those things that really stand the testament of time. And certainly with the advent of the internet, I've got younger people coming out into the community now that I certainly wasn't around to have, and they're already latching onto these things before they've even come of age. And that sort of embracing of the community very early on in life is certainly an amazing thing to see, and how it will continue to be so, I see, for quite some time.
Now, you had a launch a couple of days ago.
Yes.
How did it go?
Well, thankfully, I've now recovered. I have never done a book before. I've never done a launch before. It's been a huge learning experience, and it was amazing the amount of people that turned up and actually thanked and encouraged the actual product of this hard work.
Yeah.
So I was blown away.
Fantastic. And how are you going to sell this book? Obviously, you were selling it at the launch. Where did you hold the launch?
So I held it at Art Boy Gallery in Greville Street, Prahran.
Yep. A brilliant gallery.
Very much so. Yep. They certainly tailored to a lot of the pop culture art.
Yep.
But they also have a really warm and opening atmosphere that I certainly liked and embraced with.
Well, they do a lot of Matt Irwin's photographs, who he takes photos of Melbourne.
Yes.
And he's been on this show, and he's a brilliant photographer, and he sells a lot of stuff through there. Yes. And where else are you going to sell it?
So I'm hoping to hold it at Hares and Hyenas.
Yep.
As one of the most logical places to have any book, is you have it at a bookstore. Cool. But also Eagle Leather and Manhouse. I'm in discussion with them, holding on to a couple of copies for a while.
Yep.
But certainly through my website, furinc.com. That's FURINK.
Right. .com
is currently where the main bulk of sales are going to be done.
Now, what about internationally? You know, because there's a market for this, isn't there?
Oh, there is, very much so, given that I have been around the world and there hasn't been anything like it.
Oh, isn't there? You did mention that before.
Yes.
I can't believe that the Americans haven't done a book like this.
Not a book. They certainly have magazines such as Bear World and the like, but certainly not in a book form that I've ever found, put it that way.
Okay.
So, it's interesting that you would think that, but there's not.
Yeah, and isn't it interesting that when you start looking to see if there is other books, and you go, oh, I can't find it, I can't find anything. And the fact is that something else that's coming out of Melbourne is the thing that I find really interesting, how great this city is. I've been trying to think of, and I was trying to Google while I was talking to you. I think his name is John Grant. Do you know him, the singer? The Canadian singer. He lives in Iceland, and he's huge in England. He played the Forum Theatre only about 4 or 5 months ago. He's a bear, and he's this singer-songwriter that's really big. And one of his videos is him going to a sauna. And it's, you know, like, I know females that are big fans of his. He does really interesting things. You should check him out. He's an awesome singer. I think it's John. Okay. We've played him on this show, and Brendan, if he was here, would go, it's not John Grant, it's whatever he's, the Grant it is. But, he's an out and proud bear and played, you know, he, as I said, only 6 or 8 months ago.
Yeah, so. Look, I must admit, particularly when I was starting the book, I was starting to see certainly there were people of Bear Identity coming out and starting to become a lot more mainstream in terms of getting that sort of style out there. But certainly since the book's been released, there has been quite a few, as you say, like James Corden, who've really made
yep.
that sort of highlighted media central
yep.
starlight
yep.
That we can now point to. But
yep.
in terms of like the average person, this is, as a book, one of the starting points I would like to try and keep creating artwork that sort of focuses on the average Joe Blow that can actually say, look, I can be sexy. I look no different to this person. Why can't I look like that too?
Okay, so it's called Bear It Up by David Cookie to so many people within our community. What's the website again if people want to buy it online?
So Fur Inc., F-U-R-I-N-K.
Right. Cookie, thanks so much for coming in. And congratulations and good on you for doing this book. 3 years in the making, people. That's dedication. Thanks a lot. You're on Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy.
Now, that was First Time I Ever Saw Your Face by yes. Alison Moyet.
I never knew she did that song, but then again, I'm not that big a fan. Loved Yazoo.
Yeah.
I loved her as a solo artist.
Certainly
but,
did.
And she's touring.
Yes, she is. I heard the tickets are going on sale soon. I think it's later in the year. I think she's
right, okay.
Rod Laver, I think it is. So.
Wow.
I think
that'd be
actually the smaller one. It's Margaret Corderino.
Oh, right.
Is, yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. Great voice. And a really funny person.
Okay.
Yeah, she was part of Ab Fab crew at one stage.
Okay.
She was doing songs for them or what? Yep. Well, they were in one of her videos, like yep. the Pet Shop Boys as well. So, yeah, that's interesting.
Very.
You know, like, if you're looking for any gay people on that night, you'll know where to find them. They'll all be there.
Exactly. Now, David, before we meet our next guest, I just want to just read out a message that we received, and the message is from Melina, who says, as a Prince aficionado, his album Around the World in a Day is often compared to your favourite Beatles album.
Ah.
And look at both covers and see for yourself.
Okay, I know the cover you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah, so you might have to check that one out, I think.
Brilliant.
And now also, just letting you know, if anybody wants to text us and just have any comments on the show or would like to say anything at all to us, the number is 0427-JOY-949 or 1-300-JOY-949, or you can email us onair@joy.org.au.
Now, Neil, who's our next guest?
Yes, our next guest is Ed Morris.
Now, where's he from? He's all the way from the US of A.
From
my God.
Syracuse,
you know, like, how strong is his accent?
you were just commenting about the fact it wasn't too strong, was it? So, Ed, welcome to Melbourne, firstly.
It's great to be here.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
A little bit jet-lagged.
A little bit, yeah. Just got in this morning.
It's a long way away, isn't it?
It is a long way away. Yeah. But yet familiar.
Familiar? Why?
Well, just walking around the streets today, it's not too different from American culture, the way things feel. Everyone's speaking English.
That's the key.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And architecturally, Melbourne is very similar to New York because that's the part of the world you're from.
Correct. Yeah.
Now, give us a background on how you got to this moment in time.
Strange to say that 10 years ago, I was a private investigator working in New York City.
My God, that is so cool.
That is such a cool.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in that?
Well, it has an even stranger beginning, I guess, because I used to translate Japanese poetry. So how I got from Japanese poetry to private investigating to be an artist working on climate change, we're going to need a long time to tell that story, I guess. I was translating Japanese poetry in a PhD program, and it began to feel a little bit esoteric and cloistered of a world. So I thought I'd go to law school. And on my way to law school, I became a PI, basically.
And did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was fascinating work. My company worked for governments, financial institutions, big law firms. There's a lot of stories there.
I could imagine. And probably a lot that you can't talk about as well.
There's some that I found ways over the year to talk about specific cases without revealing the details of what they were.
So where did you turn? Where did the
I have a real
come?
Very definite kind of conversion moment. And that moment came when I was reading a series of articles in The New Yorker, the magazine New Yorker.
I love that magazine.
It's a great magazine. By Elizabeth Colbert. And the articles were called The Climate of Man, and they articulated how climate change was happening right now. And they interviewed scientists all over the world about what they were observing and made this point that there was this massive discrepancy between scientific understanding of this issue and public understanding and therefore political will. And I guess you could say that it moved me, that I was outraged in a sense, and just felt this sense of urgency that I had to do something to contribute to awareness of this issue. And my wife is a photographer. She was just out of art school at the time, and I'm this private investigator. So we launched a project to photograph landscapes around the world being impacted by climate change. And
awesome.
And it wasn't my intent for this to become my life and career, which it has now become. It was really just kind of helping Susanna, my wife, organize the project. And that's what we did. We went around the world photographing landscapes being impacted by climate change and started to exhibit them. And once we started to exhibit these photographs, we realized that there was not just one way to do it and that we wanted to reach different people. So not only did we exhibit the photographs in museums, both art museums and science museums, but also in the public sphere. So on the sides of buses, we put them into editorial content. We did lectures with them. And that kind of organically contributed to our forming a larger organization or studio called the Canary Project that both produces our own work and other work by other artists. And it's really, there's just no one way to do this. It's such an urgent issue, and there's so many ways to articulate it that we just work in diverse ways.
It must be difficult for you right this very moment, and we were talking about it off air with your current president there, who doesn't seem to care too much about climate.
It's extremely difficult. You know, I don't even like to say his name. The president, the 45th president, some people call him. It was a bit of a shock. It seemed for a moment with Obama and the rest of the world, the Paris Accord, for example, that we were finally turning the page on this issue, that we're finally reaching critical mass to actually do something about it. And along comes Donald Trump. I just said it.
Right.
50 lashes. I think that in some ways the train has already left the station and there's only so much harm that Donald Trump can do. But in other ways, there's a lot of harm that he can do. Mm. I mean, he's already set about undoing a lot of the progress that Obama made.
Yeah.
But economically speaking, I've talked to a lot of people who know more than I do about this kind of thing. And in terms of the market for renewable energies and so on, that these are sort of the invisible hand is already at work there, that there's only so much harm that Trump can do in terms of stopping these forces. So in some ways we're on our way, and in some ways we need increased awareness and vigilance about it.
So what is your role now? You're not a private investigator anymore. What are you?
So I'm an artist. The project that I mentioned, the photographic project I mentioned, kind of took off and, as I mentioned, led to the development of other projects. And so now I teach at Syracuse University. I teach in the art department. I make work with Susanna Saylor, my wife and collaborator, quite a wide variety of projects, but all focus on climate change and other ecological issues.
Can you give us a heads up of, maybe one piece that you've made?
Sure, yeah. Well, actually, I'm taking a break to be here in Melbourne from an install that's currently happening in Chicago. So this is a work that was commissioned by a museum called the American Writers Museum, and they commissioned Susanna and I to come up with a piece that would articulate how writers can put us in touch with nature, connect us to nature in some way. And so we're developing an installation, an immersive installation that is inspired by the poet W.S. Merwin. As I leave here, I'll go right back to that install, and it'll open on May 6th, actually. So,
right. And how hard is it to pull yourself away from being there, or have you just got, oh, you can cope
with it? It's very hard. Yeah, it's very, it's funny you mention that. I literally wake up in the middle of the night with anxiety about what's going on back there. It's a, there's 16 channels of audio. We have live plants in the installation, so hopefully it's going okay.
Yeah, and the fact is that modern technology these days, you could be, I'm sure you've spoken to her at some stage in the last 24 hours anyway.
Yeah, we have quite a team working on it. So, right. So yeah, I mean, we had gotten to a point when I left where it was comfortable enough for me to go.
Right. Yeah. We'll be back to find out why you're here in Melbourne. We're talking with Ed Morris. You're on Joy 94.9 at Sunday Arts Magazine.
Bringing a little joy to your life. Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine. And we're currently talking to Ed Morris about his works at the moment, what he's actually doing here in Melbourne. Welcome back, Ed.
Thank you.
So tell us, what is, well, we know exactly what it is, but explain to us, what is Art Plus Climate?
So it's a festival here in Melbourne and the surrounding area that brings together a number of works, very diverse works, that deepen our understanding of climate change in some way or provoke a response to it. I was invited by the festival organizers, Guy Abrahams and Bronwyn Johnson, to give a talk tomorrow night at University of Melbourne, articulating my view on how art can contribute to social change, particularly about climate change.
We have some amazing organizations here that are doing art and science together, mm-hmm. the importance of, art helping science and vice versa.
Right.
How can art help climate?
In many ways. I mean, so you mentioned science, and I think that I think of art and science not as oppositional forces, but as complementary forces, yep. And they're different types of knowing. You cannot understand climate change simply on the data alone. You have to have an emotional understanding of it as well, and so that's how art works with science.
And as you were saying, your wife being a photographer, mm-hmm. Visually, that's an important way of seeing the damages that we're doing to this world.
Yeah, and it's not simply, although documentary is one form that this can take. It's not simply seeing it. It's actually understanding the implications of it. And the Climb Art Festival is really admirable in terms of bringing together different ways of making us understand. There's a data visualization project called Exit. There's a film by John Emphora. There's photography. There's lots of different ways of seeing the same issue.
What do you think is one of the most important messages that you can get across as an artist on this platform?
The most important message is that life is at stake. Mm-hmm. And I think that people have a greater difficulty understanding the potential of trauma and climate change than they do knowledge of the science. And I feel like the purpose of all art, if you can make a blanket statement, which is always a bit risky, that all art provokes empathy, that creates empathy. And I think that creation of caring or investment in the issue is the most important thing that art can do.
Beautifully said. What would you like to see in the next 5 years? Something can't happen overnight. Is there one thing that you would really like to see happen within your world?
I mean, from a policy perspective?
Yeah.
The biggest thing that can make a difference is the readjustment of subsidies and governmental support away from the fossil fuel industry and towards the renewable energy industry. A lot of times when we think about climate change, we think of it almost in a guilt response, like what can I do as a consumer? And while those things are important, reducing your own energy usage, ultimately the main thing that's going to make a difference is transforming our energy economy away from fossil fuels.
Yeah. And that's obviously a government situation,
right.
And we don't want to keep on harping back to your homeland, but right. And within our own there's problems as well. How do you get to governments within that arena?
Well, today, for example, is in Washington, D.C., is a climate march.
Yep.
And, we're fortunate to live in democracies. And the principle of democracy is still actually alive and vital. And that is, our own former President Abraham Lincoln once said that with public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. And it's the role of people to provide, to put pressure on governments to act. And so I think things like the climate march today, I think things like writing your senators are extremely important in terms of provoking government response.
Are they listening? Do you think they're listening? Or is it, you know, like, within your government in America at present, is he, you know, like sweeping things under the carpet, or is there enough people working with him that they are looking at, the people power?
Time will tell, but I think it's interesting. There have been reports in the New York Times and other places that there is unanticipated internal debate within the administration, for example, about whether to try and get out of the Paris Accord. So there are voices within the administration that are pro-climate, that are trying to advocate. And I do think these things make a difference, like the climate march. I mean, Trump himself is extremely sensitive to public opinion. So the rubber hits the road at election time, but even before election time, I think there's almost a constant call and response in terms of polling and reaction to polling. And so what the people say is listened to.
Okay. Yeah. And what is the main message that you're doing in your speech tomorrow night?
It's the main message is that art contributes to social movements, and social movements are what create change. So I quoted Abraham Lincoln a moment ago about public sentiment and so on. That's the way the government functions. Well, I think of art as contributing to public sentiment. That's why we need culture change in order to change policy. Culture change comes first. And so that's what, you know, people are inspired to go out into the street by what they see in art and other places.
Yeah. And art does have a real impact, doesn't it? You know, like it really does on so many levels.
Absolutely. And you know, art is a funny word too. I almost don't like to think about it in terms of art because that can have such a high art connotation. It's all culture, and you see culture in different places. Yep. And the authority that a museum or other institutions confer upon art is important, and that people respect that. But also the emotional response that individuals get when they see it.
Are you aware of Melbourne and its love of the arts?
I understand that Melbourne is sort of, particularly compared to Sydney, is sort of the intellectual capital of Australia. Someone told me maybe something like that.
Tell people that.
Okay, I got the advanced PR on that.
That would be a Melbourne person saying that.
Yeah.
But very much on the arts tip. You know, like this city is just so robust in that arena. Mm. So therefore, it's obvious that this event is happening here.
Yeah.
And street art is playing a big part of a movement in this city as well.
Uh-huh.
Is it big in America?
Street art?
Yeah.
Sure. In fact, there's a couple of very prominent street artists who are both very active climate people. Swoon and Banksy have both done a number of projects for climate.
I'm a huge Banksy fan, but he's not yours though. He's English.
It's true.
But he's going to America more and more, isn't he?
You see him a lot. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. So where are you tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night I'll be at the University of Melbourne at the Carrillo Ganter Theatre.
Yep.
So it's on Swanston Street and it starts at 6:30.
Right. And which is, of course, is May 1st, and it's all part of iArt Plus Climate Festival. Thank you so much for coming in,
and thank you
for coming to Australia. And it's you're doing some really good stuff, so congratulations.
Thank you for having me.
You're on Joy 94.9 at Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy.
You're listening to Joy 94.9 on Sunday Arts Magazine. Now, we just heard Young Folks by Peter Bjorn and John earlier on. And we have a couple of messages, actually, from Donna, who says, OMG, Alison, thank you, lovelies. That was for the song we played before that. And then we also have another one from Colin in Abbotsford, who says, loving the version of First Time. So that was also the Alison Moyer one that we played. And I think Donna did confirm that she'll be coming out here in October. So now, on Sunday Arts, we've got a new segment, which will be running monthly. And you've all heard from Fiona. So this is Fiona Brooks, and this will be Fiona Presents. So Fiona, it's your turn to shine.
Thank you, Neil, so much. Well, it is very exciting to have, you know, my own little segment. And I've kicked it off with an incredible talent who's visiting our shores at the moment, Mr. Jack Ferver. Jack,
wonderful to be here.
Thank you. It's so exciting that you've taken time out of your Sunday to be here. You're only here for a short time. So
I know, it feels too short. I'm already trying to plan when to come back, if not just move here.
I think you should move here. You would love it.
It's sort of that thing of, I do understand that hyperbole runs in my blood quite strongly, so I can really fall in love or fall in hate really fast. And as soon as arriving in Melbourne, I thought, I love it here. I have to move here. How am I going to do it? How am I going to escape the USA finally?
Well, we would welcome you very, very much so, because obviously we have a strong dance community here. Yeah. And you're in.
And theater. Yeah.
Oh, incredible. The art scene.
I love that sign. And I think it's your Melbourne theater company, MTC. And there was some sign that I walked by yesterday that said, "We bring the drama." Something like that. It was really good. I thought, I could work there. I know how to bring the drama.
Well, speaking of drama, you were invited by our own Philip Adams from Ballet
Yes.
Lab to bring your form of drama here to Melbourne.
Yeah.
So you'll be performing at Temperance Hall coming up, the new home of Ballet Lab.
It's so incredible. I mean, he just moved in November, so he's only been in residence there 6 months. I'm his first international presentation, of which I'm incredibly honored to be.
Ah, indeed.
I got this email out of the blue from him. I mean, I knew of Philip and of Ballet Lab. I'd never met him, and I received an email from him at some point last year asking if I'd be up for coming here, and I was shocked and happy to do that. I hadn't been here. My friend David Hallberg was here for a year, the principal dancer at ABT rehabbing, and so I was seeing photos, Instagram photos of Melbourne, and thinking, I want to go there. And then the goddess heard me.
Yes.
And had it all work out.
And the goddess was Philip.
Yeah, and the goddess was Philip, truly. The goddess of Melbourne and the prince among men.
So you will be performing a piece called Mon Mames.
Mm-hmm.
And this is
Mon Mames. I'm going to do it with a sonati, French
you
accent.
You do love anything to do with France.
I am indeed.
Are you a Francophile?
I am a Francophile, for sure. In my heritage, my mother's side is Transylvanian Romanian, so that's my whole witch part. And then my father's side is French, and that's probably my snobby elitism, even though I make performance work. So obviously I don't function in a lot of wealth. Really, the snotty elitism of someone like Jean Genet, you know, poor but gets it.
And you're a big fan of Genet's work?
Deeply. Deep
Absolutely.
Fan of Genet. I mean, it's Genet, now I'm going to sound really snobby. Genet, Barthes, Sartre. I just gave my friend Parker, who we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. I gave her a Les Enfants Terribles as soon as we met by Cocteau as a piece to make together. And yeah, so Mon Mames, Mine is the name of this solo. And in this case, Revisite, because it premiered in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Through the French Institute Alliance Française Crossing the Line. Because it's a solo and therefore far more affordable than my larger pieces, mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. it started to tour more, I wanted to change it. And I wanted to change it alongside of where my process as an artist was changing, as well as my concerns. Because when I first made it, I was 30, and mm-hmm. my life has changed greatly since then. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
And then, how do you think it's morphed into? I mean, are you always aware of how it's going to change? Do you have ideas about what you want it to change into, or is it really going to be something that develops in the next few days that you're here?
In the next few days, I can imagine it changing as well. I mean, it also depends on, so another thing that's true in my process is I'm very obsessed with films.
So there's a lot of cinematic references in your work.
A lot. And in the last iteration, and then there's a section that's in there, is based on Cassavetti's opening night,
mm-hmm.
as I, as I got older, as my mother died, as then my father died, and starting to think about myself in terms of my own aging and as a performer, there's a section, I don't think anyone will see that it's opening night in it unless you really know the sound score to that film well. So there was a whole section that came from that, and there's a considering where the displacement that I feel myself, certainly as a queer person and coming, what's going on in my country politically, that is even further on my skin and further pumping through my blood. So senses of mystery or things that inspire me. I just finished the Elena Ferrante books.
Oh, and that I read those.
Dangerous writing for the psyche. So I think... I'm always open to change. And then, you know, of course the audience changes things. When I was younger, I didn't allow for that. I was so strident. I'd come out of the Graham technique and I felt I had this deep need for perfection. And now I'm open a little more to the Dionysian.
It seems almost as if, from what I've seen of your work, that you're almost asking something of the audience. Mm-hmm. It's like you're going through this cathartic psychoanalytic, experience. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if you're asking the audiences, like, what do you want to expect or want the audiences to take away from, you know, being at one of your pieces? I think Philip told me that he felt like he'd just come out of a therapy session.
Yeah. Well, if I wasn't doing what I was doing, I probably would be a psychoanalyst. And maybe if I get really tired later on, I'll just want to sit in a chair and deal with my audience one by one. So, you know, I was here also teaching a workshop these last 2 days, and something I always do. And I also teach at Bard College, which is a college in upstate New York. And when I begin the semester or a workshop, I ask the students to give me their one sentence on why they make work. I find that really imperative because as you're a maker and you don't get the grant or you get the bad review, you have to have something you can get to quickly to remember why you're doing this. Mm-hmm. For me, it's been the same since I started, and it's only deepened in that I make my work so that people don't feel so alone. It is a myth that of course we come into this world and out of this world alone, but that we're alone while we're here is not true. And these currents, these similarities that we have, that is the great gift that art can do. Mirrors are really important in my work. And in many ways, what I am seeking to do is to mirror the human psyche, to mirror my audience, to ventilate. So frequently, I'm also showing the things that you don't want to see, which is what a mirror does. We don't want to have a pimple, and yet we get one. So instead of the panic arising around that, and maybe that's what I want to ventilate, is panic or a sense of obsessively looking at the flaws, as well as, I would say, in my work, there's a great deal of humor, because humor is so relieving. It's such medicine.
I was just actually going to raise that point, because there is you sort of mock gently and sometimes not so gently forms of classical dance, modern dance, classical ballet, and so many aspects that I think people would really find it so humorous, and it would relieve their sort of sense that they don't need to understand those things. You can actually just enjoy it, make fun of it, and there's so much nostalgia built into your work.
Thank you. And thank you. Nostalgia is something that I'm also realizing as I'm growing up is so important and so embedded inside of my work. And in terms of humor and classicism, I think that's something that I'm also actively participating in a friction of. I didn't grow up with money. I was very lucky by getting a scholarship here and there and getting a film that enabled me to move to New York. And inside of all of that, I think there was a sense of trying to reach for something I wasn't part of. I suppose that's another place in ways that I connect with an author like Jean Genet. And then this sort of surprise that arriving in a kind of, that upper whatever level of the art world in New York, and then remembering where I come from. And so looking at how to still deal with indictment also of myself, in a way to even tear myself apart and to always remain familiar or with the family of where I come from, because I'll never be able to outrun that.
Well, the New Yorker magazine had said of your work that it has the look and feel of an exorcism.
They can. And I think, what were you going to say before I interrupted you?
Well, I was just, I mean, having seen some of your work, only, of course, on YouTube, I was just wondering about that exorcism. Is that something that you process, that you go through each time that you're performing, and how challenging that must be to keep presenting and over and over?
It It is. I've been thinking lately about how much I've, I'm currently also writing a memoir, and there's something, and part of that also came out of, there's a lot of, script in my work. There are these plays that have dance in them.
Yeah, and, it's very actually.
Very, very. Well, I come from theater, and then I also had this dance training. So for me, it's so much about using these different forms in service of my content. So using dance or using theater, using visual art in service of what the content of the piece is, what the theme of the piece is. But in terms of this process, why I brought that up is I've become aware of how much pleasure there can be in the process, and then this real pain in performance that is, mm-hmm. it's actually mm-hmm. getting worse as I have found that, because it's always becoming more and more truthful for me. I'm feeling it more and more. Mm-hmm. In my 20s, I made this work that I had to make it. I had to get it out. And there was mm-hmm. a real sense of, rage and of course humor and pathos. And it wasn't a show if I didn't bleed. And now, the pain though has become even deeper and more profound, and because there's more nuance. And isn't that what happens as we get older?
Well, you're feeling it a little bit more,
yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah, I think now I'm having, what the artist Ryan Tricarton has called a total read. It's this sense of the full weight of this material, as well as its mysteriousness.
It almost begs the question of how far will it go?
Right.
Where will it go next?
And I don't think I'll ever get to know. I mean, that's sort of what keeps me in the game. Otherwise I would have gone ahead and started making films or videos or something that I could hold on to more. And I do want to start making video work because I'm so sentimental and performance. But what's so great about performance and live art and why I keep doing it and why I teach it is there's something it is immediate in the room. It is actually also what I think is going to continue to help us as a society that's so inundated things with like reality television. But how can we still get the audience out of their homes to have this real connection that's so needed? We're needing this connection more than ever of direct experience of the one-to-one with the audience and the performer to again continually ventilate and create this catharsis of our not aloneness.
You know, I noticed that you haven't performed that much outside of the US.
Correct. Yeah.
Well, I hope that the Melbourne audiences, well, I know the Melbourne audiences will be embracing, but do you think perhaps there's something so sort of distinctly New York City about your work?
I can see a real Americanism to the work because of not only its dark humor, so the sense of humor that I have, and I actually found that very similar to the people who I've been meeting in Melbourne. There's this sense of dark humor here. That, and because there's so much English text, is something where I've done one piece in Paris, but I mean, even a sort of French crowd, I felt was confused by that humor. Mm. Because it's not directly funny and it's not directly tragic. So it's doing this tragic comedy that I'm very excited to be here because it makes me think of what I just saw The Dressmaker recently, which was such a bizarre film. And my people in America could potentially struggle with something that, that has that dynamism. But that kind of tragic comedy that's inherent of a culture that when we're looking at sort of where are both the American culture or the Australian culture, where we come from in terms of England, I think that sort of dark humor is where it sits. And actually, I find these two cultures very similar. So I'm actually very excited to perform here to continually open up and see that dialogue.
We are excited about that too. We're going to go for a quick break and come back in a second.
Great.
A diverse sound for a diverse crowd. Joy 94.9.
Okay, you're here on Joy 94.9, and this is our Sunday Arts Magazine. We've actually got a couple of messages, Fiona, and I just want to just read them out very quickly. The first one was from Daryl with just one R. Here's, so good to be able to hear your voice, David. I must say that I really miss you, both you and Sue on Friday Drive. Fridays haven't been the same since you left. As always, a great show. And David's saying thank you. He's just off the mic at the moment, Daryl. So
that's very lovely, Daryl. Thank you.
Thank you, Daryl. And also, Melina has messaged in again saying, will Le Pen make France great again like Trump did? So what's your view on French politics?
I was just talking about this earlier in terms of, have this sinking feeling that Le Pen is going to win. And I have felt the same way in terms of Trump. I wasn't one of the people who said this isn't going to happen. I grew up in a very rural place in Wisconsin, and so I grew up with people who would be in full support of something like that. That's a big part of why I left and escaped. And it's part of this global trend, which again, it comes down to categorical thinking. That's where we're in big trouble always as a society, in that it begins with you, me, and then all problems stem out from there. And it continually creates this conflict of, well, this is mine and I want more of it. And I think it's, we're in this place of people who are upset and concerned with this feeling that they don't have enough. And then they're very easy to control in that. And that's what we're seeing in a sort of more global way. So, the way I feel about, the thing with Le Pen is she's, for better or worse, she's articulate, in a way that, that's certainly not happening with Trump. And, she has this great, she's also very loved by the neo-fascists in Italy. It's interesting. They've really picked up on her as well. So, I don't feel great. No, it's a big part of what's also why I'm staying in and making art and teaching and continuing to look for, performance and art and these things that, can bring people together. We're in this real time of if you just say whatever and, we're really watching this mediocrity rise to the top of people just being able to be inarticulate and, a bully. And it gains this traction. I mentioned reality television earlier, and I think it's part of what we're looking at. You know, it's part of where, people are starting to celebritize, things that, are shocking and, that they are trying to find a sense of power behind. And there's a big difference though between, power that comes from care and a societal purpose and one that comes from destruction. You know, it is called divide and conquer. It's not called unify and conquer. No. And I'm more on the unify side.
So it must be very rewarding when you're teaching students at Bard and also maybe from your teaching students here. Were there choreographers you were teaching yesterday? Is that correct?
Both. It was both. I had a lot of theater students in there as well.
It must be really fantastic to be able to translate and to provide a space for them to increase and continue to work. I mean, that's a really important component of what they need to do, and they need to be encouraged at all times.
As the song says, the children are the future, and I believe it. And I really, you know, I'm trying as a teacher and as an artist, I'm trying to be a lot of what I didn't have.
Yeah,
and that's the responsibility of being an adult. I mean, that is the thing that is so horrifying about this leadership that of looking to, terrify people, to divide them and thereby conquer them. That is not adult behavior. Adult behavior is teaching people their worth, their value, helping, bring out from them. I mean, the meaning of education is to bring out, not to put on, not to beat someone down and put on, but education means to bring out. So as a teacher, I'm looking to bring out the fact that they are genius and create the conditions for that to flourish.
Well, I think that we would love to have you back in Australia because we would love so much to see more of your work.
I hope to be back. I love, you know, I really do. I love Melbourne so much. I've been completely, I've really fallen in love with this city, and I hope I'm back a lot if I don't just move here.
Yes, we think you should move here. So, Jack, your show will be at the Temperance Hall.
At Temperance Hall, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
That will be incredible. And that's in South Melbourne, the new home of Ballet Lab. We'll be looking forward to seeing you there. I think there are certainly tickets still available. I haven't checked.
I think Thursday sold out, and we still have seats, I think, on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And Sunday's show is at 5. And I think it's all through Ballet Lab in terms of where to look to get the tickets. And my website is just myname.org. Someone bought the .com when I was doing a TV show, and I couldn't buy it back from them. So I had to do .org, like the good nonprofit I am.
Oh, I think org is far more interesting.
Thank you. I do like to stay interesting and sexy.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you. I will be there on Thursday evening.
Great.
And welcome, and I'll I hope you have a fabulous time when you do the
show. Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been an honor. Thank you.
But before you all go, there's just one. Sorry, Melina's just messaging again. Yeah. So, Melina, thank you for this. It's palatable fascism with Le Pen. So it's just her comment about your comments off the French politics at the moment. So
absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Sunday Arts on Joy 94.9. And now we're going to be playing Katie Noonan and Karen Sharp in Into My Arms.
To my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms.
A diverse sound for a diverse crowd. Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine, and we're back here now with David, and we've got our next guest, David.
Yes.
Which is Joanna Murray-Smith, who's a playwright.
Oh, I think we've heard of her before. I think she's been on this show. Third time on the show.
I know. I hope your listeners aren't turning off.
No. Why would they turn off?
Exactly.
Yeah, like, you are the best. You know, like, your new play with Melbourne Theatre Company called Three Little Words, open last Saturday night. I was blown away. So congratulations.
Thank you, David.
Yala, it is such a well-constructed play. You have come, you didn't know what was going to happen next.
No.
You know, the way it unfolded. How long did it take you to write it?
I wrote that play very, very fast, which is sort of, I think, why it is a fast-moving play. It has a lot of scenes that are very quickly in succession, and it's got a kind of an energy to it which is fairly intense and kind of fluid, and I think that's because it's the way I wrote it. It was kind of, you know, the material that comes most easily to me, which is the kind of crazy, hypocritical, joyful, bizarre human behaviour in normal domestic relationships.
Yeah, and believe me, it went off in so many different areas. Beautifully directed for a play like this, which was so, as you said, very fast moving.
Yeah.
So well acted. We'll get to the actors, but who directed it?
Sarah Goods, who directed my last play, Switzerland, which started in Sydney, but that production came to Melbourne.
Now this one, Three Little Words, was this is the world premiere, wasn't
this
it?
This was the world premiere.
Whoa!
Which is, you know, really lovely. But it has already been sold to Germany, so I'm really excited about that. I'm kind of gobsmacked, you know, what are the Germans going to make of this? But someone who I saw yesterday said anywhere where there are long-term domestic relationships, intimate relationships, will find a way of connecting with this, regardless of your kind of nationality, regardless of your sexuality, regardless of your gender or class. You know, there are just some fundamentals about human behaviour which are...
And that's what I loved about it, is that you hit it right down the middle. You got it so right, because quite often, with live theatre, you often go, come on. Where I felt this was very real, but very funny. Do you like writing comedy?
Well, most writers neither like nor dislike how they write. That's just how they write. And so even when I'm sort of setting out to tackle a serious idea, which in a way Three Little Words is a serious idea, it's what the whole play opens with, the idea of one couple, the straight couple, telling their closest friends, a lesbian couple, that despite their long and very happy marriage and their deep continuing feelings for one another, they've decided to split. And so the play is about the outcome of this announcement of, first of all, their closest friends, Bonnie and Annie, trying to decipher why on earth they're splitting.
They were so shocked and pissed off, which I find really funny.
And threatened. Yes. Yeah.
Like the foursome is no longer a foursome.
That's right. And they kind of examine the situation and realise that what the attraction was between these four people was that they were two couples, not four individuals. And so the first thing they have to face is that they don't necessarily want to be friends with the other two as separate entities.
Yep.
You know, it was about the couple life. So that's the first problem. But then there are all those other thoughts when people close to us break up, which is, do they just have higher standards of happiness than we do? You know, that's a terrifying thought.
Yep.
And when Tess, the straight wife, says, look, I don't even know why exactly. My feeling is I've spent more of my life with him than I've spent on my own, and I want to know who I am again.
Yeah. Well, that is a problem that a lot of people do, you know, like as you, the older you get, you think, well, you know, where am I going? What am I doing? And it's that 7-year itch, but it goes beyond there.
Well, I think particularly in that age group, sort of in your 40s, where you're not young anymore, but you're also not old, and mortality has first begun to kind of raise its head, and you begin to hear the sound of the ticking clock, and you're thinking, well, okay, I can't be relaxed about the way I live my life anymore. I have to be very conscious of the way I live my life. And part of that is analysing your love affairs, analysing everything that is part of your day-to-day existence and wondering, is this good enough, or should I be needing something, getting something more than I've been happy with until now?
Now, what I loved about it, and you said you didn't take long to write it, which blows me away, is that the research you did, you know, like, and it's not...
25 years of marriage, yeah.
But you're still married, though.
I've researched this play for a long, long time.
You're taking us on a journey that so many of us aren't, you know, like we've had friends or and that have broken up, but but it's that personal side of it. And I don't want to give too much away, because as the play unfolds, situations happen that you know, like every corner you turn, it's a new surprise. But it was that really made me think that it shocked me, the fact that you didn't take all that long to write it.
No, and also it shocks a lot of people that I haven't been through a marriage breakup.
Yeah.
She says nervously, looking around the studio for a bit of wood to tap.
Underneath,
okay. The thing, I guess, that I wanted to do in this play was I wanted to write a play which, you know, on the face of it sounds very ordinary, a play about a marriage breakup. Everybody knows about marriage breakups. There's nothing particularly original about it. But I wanted to do it in such a way that it was very funny at times and very, very serious and very vicious and tough and real at times. And for that, to be able to turn on a dime, so that one moment you're laughing. I mean, this was my hope for the play, and I'm not the best judge of whether I realised it or not, but that one moment you're laughing and the next moment the audience is really very, very still and very silent, because they're recognising the absolute brutality with which people treat each other, and usually reserving that degree of savagery for our most intimate relationships and ironically with the people we love most in the world. And this is what happens with Tess and Curtis, is you see them really unpeel each other in the most, in a way that you can't, in a way, or feel as if you can't come back from.
Yep.
Once certain things are said, they can't be unsaid. And yet somehow I think the feeling through the course of the play, without revealing the plot, is that people do go on, that we somehow will on some level forgive each other for each other's, you know, flaws, for each other's cruelty, and accept it as part of the huge contradiction that is love.
What I also want to talk about is the set. The set is so well done. I don't want to give anything away, because I think the set is another element so much of the four
Absolutely.
Actors. And the actors are so good. So it's almost a fifth wheel as an actor. It has so much impact. So I just wanted to mention that. Let's get to the actors, because...
Hang on, we should say that the set is by Michael Hankin, who
yes.
is a very, very talented young man who brought his beautiful little puppy, Carol, every day to rehearsals. Oh. We're all going through, all of us are going through Carol withdrawals at the moment. moment. But Michael's really quite brilliant. Yeah, I think we're all going to be hearing a lot more about him.
Yeah, well yes, because it was a brilliant set. The actors, four actors,
yes.
They're the only people on stage the whole time. Who are they?
Catherine McClements plays the straight wife. Peter Houghton plays Curtis, her husband. Kate Atkinson plays Annie, one of the lesbian couple. And Kath Tonkin plays Bonnie, the other in that couple. And Bonnie is a kind of la-di-da gallerist, very bossy. Annie is a kind of diminutive masseuse. And they are Tess and Curtis's best friends, Curtis being a school teacher and Tess being a disenchanted book editor. And they really have a very robust friendship. They've known each other forever. They've gone through a lot of difficulty together, a lot of good times, a lot of bad times, a lot of holidays. And so this is an absolute bombshell, not just into the life of Curtis and Tess, but a bombshell into the little universe that these two couples have composed for themselves.
They must be absolutely exhausted by the end of the play each night. It's very, again, can't give too much away, which is, you know, like, go out and see it, people, so we can have this conversation, so you can all join in. That, you know, like, it becomes quite physical in the end, very physical in the end. But the acting is so emotional, isn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant acting. Look, the four of them, you know, when you have an ensemble piece like this where it's really four equal parts, you know, they're all part of the jigsaw puzzle to about the same degree, which is very pleasurable as a writer writing that way instead of writing little parts,
yeah.
You know, and you sort of worry about the actor not having enough to do. Everybody's got something to do in this play. Everyone's got a role, a big role in the play. And you just sort of know round about halfway through week one of rehearsals whether that particular magic of an ensemble is going to be there. The play can still work without it, but there's a particular pleasure in a play that's structured that way when all of the actors both love each other as human beings, as this lot do. They're kind of, you know, so revoltingly thespian-y, touchy-feely all the time, hugging and blowing each other kisses. They all adore each other. Let's see if they're still like that by the end of the run. But they're also all equally talented in their particular roles. And the really pleasurable thing is that they're three of them at least, perhaps Catherine McClements not so much, who a lot of people have seen in dramatic roles, very, very talented actress. But certainly the other three, Peter Houghton, Kate Atkinson, Kath Tonkin, are very well known for their comedy. And so it's fantastic seeing them plumb these other depths in this play as well, having the opportunity to be really tough and really sad and really threatened and anxious, as well as their usual thing, which is making us laugh. But the fun in the theatre, I mean, when you say they must be so exhausted, they are exhausted every night, but they're also really kind of exhilarated because
of the audience.
Because of the audience. And the audiences it's been like, someone said to me, it's like the Colosseum. You know, it's like there's so much audience interaction, you know, people spontaneously clapping or ooing or aahing or gasping or even kind of hissing in a couple of places where they are really take umbrage at something that one of the characters says to another one where they're being particularly mean. The audience seems to be, I mean, you say the set is the fifth character, the audience is the sixth character in this play. Yep.
And you would see that more than me.
Well, I definitely feel it in the audience, but the actors, more to the point, are feeling it on stage. You know, they say it's just an incredible experience to be up there and have the audience sort of participate in the play. So
Now, when Melbourne Theatre Company came to you and said they wanted a new piece to premiere, did you already have this in mind, or was it then you then went, oh, okay, what am I going to do?
Well, you know, there's a whole lot of very strategic, very pragmatic issues that people don't realise go into the life of a playwright. So, for instance, Brett Sheehy, who runs the Melbourne Theatre Company, said, you know, let's get going and commission this play of yours, which was not Three Little Words. It was another play. And I wanted very much to have a play in this year's season for a whole lot of reasons, but I didn't feel that play, which is going to be my next play, I hope, was ready. And, and so I kind of thought, well, you know, I might give it a shot to write this play, which is sort of bubbling up. Brett's not expecting it. But I really feel I can write this play fast because I feel like all of the ideas and all the energy behind this play are very much sort of at the top of my brain at the moment. And whereas the other play feels like it was a sort of a long, slow build. So I went to Brett and I said, look, I know you're going to commission this other play, but I actually want you to commission this play first. And this is, and it took a little bit of convincing because I think Brett was sort of a bit, you know, play about relationships. Another Joanna Murray Smith play about relationships. Don't you think you've plumbed those depths by now? But I persuaded him and he said to me on opening night how thrilled he was that, that I had persuaded him.
Yeah. Oh, look. A gem. You know, I've got to. I've seen so many of your plays, and I've followed you.
David.
So, and you know, like you're doing so well. You know, like already sold it to the to Germany.
I hope they get the gags.
Well, the English will really love it. And our last guest on, who's from New York, said, he really gets the vibe that Melbourne, New York is
on a similar.
Yeah,
I think that's probably true. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, some of my plays work and some don't, and some productions are good and some aren't, but I never really feel that they're excluded from any particular territory. They kind of feel like they could be anywhere.
Yep.
And so it's all, I mean, not all of the players go on to have a life in other places, but when
most
it does
do.
Happen, yep. it's such a nice feeling.
Yep. Joanna Murray-Smith, thank you so much for another wonderful
David.
Play. Melbourne Theatre Company's Three Little Words, running till when?
Until towards the end of May.
Right.
Isn't that terrible? I can't even tell you the
But everyone knows what to do. Just go on online and book a ticket now. You can't miss this one. It's a killer. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, David.
Joy 94.9.
Okay, you're listening to Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine, and David, we're coming towards the end of the show again.
Those 2 hours go so fast. And I hope everyone liked Fiona's new spot, Fiona Brook Presents, a new spot that we're going to do once a month. And look at the quality of the people she's going to bring in.
Exactly.
For us.
So I'm looking forward to that. So it's really interesting. And just before we go, there is also another message we've got. Now, unfortunately, they didn't leave their name, but they were saying what a delightful show today was.
Oh, thank you.
Very interesting interview. Sounding great, David, as always.
Oh, thanks so much. Do you know what? We really appreciate getting your messages. But unfortunately, the people that's following us, they're standing. I was going to be horrible to them, but they're the evil eye they're giving us. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. We hope you enjoy it. And don't forget, Radiothon, a launch party, which is on the eve before Radiothon on the Thursday the 11th. Come along to it. It's going to be a lot of fun down in St Kilda at Rabada.
Yes, it will be. And before your stick once more comes on, we've got Bassam with the news.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.